Deuteronomy 26. I've got now David Horvath. Is he here today? David Horvath said he types out all his notes and his scriptures. And yet he also brings this. And so I am doing that as well. I've got all my scriptures typed out and I'll read from that. However, if somebody struggles to take the lectern away because they don't believe what I say is the truth, I have this. And we will wrestle over that truth. Deuteronomy 26. I love Deuteronomy. I can't get out of Deuteronomy these days. It begins talking about how the Israelites were to live their lives once they've come through the wilderness of sin and they finally entered the promised land. The promised land, their inheritance, promised by God. It talks about tithes and offerings and the wonderful blessings that naturally come as a result of following God's way. And I'd like to start in verse 16. Verse 16. And just to keep everybody's attention and to keep my daughter Marissa's attention, because she likes visual aids, I have visual aids today, and I'm going to sneak them out one at a time. So you'll be able to see some visual aids up here at the front of the lectern today. Verse 16, it says, "This day the Lord your God commands you to observe these statutes and judgments. Therefore you shall be careful to observe them with all your heart and with all your soul." Today, you know, if you think about it, we really have a contract language going on here. We have a nice agreement coming into place. 17 says, "Today you have proclaimed." You have proclaimed. Yeah, that's a wonderful way for fathers to judge their children, by the way. You know, kids have all sorts of things to say. And if they're saying the right things, you can always say, "But you said..." And then we bring them back around. This is the way this is worded too. "Today you have proclaimed the Lord to be your God, and that you will walk in his ways and keep his statutes, his commandments, and his judgments, and that you will obey his voice. Also today the Lord has proclaimed you to be his special people." And the King James Version calls that word special, peculiar, peculiar. "Just as he promised you that you should keep all his commandments," in verse 19, "and that he will set you high above all the nations which he has made, in praise, in name, and in honor, and that you may be a holy people to the Lord your God, just as he has spoken." So notice all this agreement and contract language that we have here. We've got "you have proclaimed." We've got God promising things. We've got promises exchanged. We clearly have an agreement here. The title today is "A Peculiar People, A Peculiar Way." That word "peculiar" has always been a little peculiar to me. I've always wanted to kind of dive into it a little bit and see what that really means. Interesting word, peculiar. What is it that separates us from the world? Let's take a look at that word a little bit. I've actually heard an interesting phrase lately on the radio. Like, let's do this. Let's unpack that phrase a little bit. Let's unpack that word. Just the word "peculiar." See it defined. That word in the original Hebrew, according to Strong's Concordance, is segula. Segula. We have segula, we have not segula. This is worth a lot of money. Does anybody recognize what color that is? We mine this out on Fushi Mountain, you see? All right? That's right. Okay. We have segula and not segula. Now that word means possession. This is the word "peculiar." It means possession, property, valued property, a peculiar treasure. It means special. It means jewel. It means particular treasure, wealth, private property, often used to describe the people of Israel. Segula and not segula. All of a sudden, that word peculiar doesn't seem quite so bad, does it? It doesn't mean, now, we all think we're all peculiar people, right? And, you know, we know people that are peculiar, and we could point fingers at people who are peculiar. We like to do that in the church. Unfortunately, that distracts us. It doesn't mean weird or strange. It means special. Notice the difference in these two things. We have something that's very special, something that's set apart. Set apart as precious by God. We have God's very special valued property and treasure. Now, how do we respond to that? How do we respond to that word peculiar now? This isn't a philosophy that's unique to the Old Testament. This is all through the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I'd like to just go over to 1 Peter 2:7 and read a few scriptures over there to show that. 1 Peter, beginning in verse 7, 1 Peter 2, verse 7, it says, "Therefore, to you who believe, he is precious, but to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense." Have we ever thought of God's word as offensive? I've thought of it as offensive before. If I consider God's word according to my flesh, it is offensive. It's spiritual. And we have two offensive things going on towards each other, two diametrically opposite forces. We've got the flesh and we've got the spirit. I may be in dangerous territory today, but that's just fine because I'm sticking close to my text. "They stumble, being disobedient to the word to which they also were appointed." But verse 9, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special," in other words, peculiar people, "that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." Speaking of this peculiar people, all these peculiar, special, set apart, holy, precious people, like the ones that are in this room right now. Now, why did God choose to do that? Why did he set apart a people at that time? Well, God chose to do it that way. He just chose to do it that way. He loves us. And he considers us very special. Now, I have special people in my home. Very special people. Not that everybody here is not special. However, I'm just a little bit biased because I've spent 22 years with one of them. And 18, 15, and 11 with others of them. Now, why is Marissa special to me? Why would she be considered a special little thing to me? Well, I jotted down a few things. I'll tell you a little bit about Marissa. Now, she needs daddy time. Sherry reminds me that Marissa needs daddy time from time to time. She comes to talk to me about anything and everything. She's very special to me. This week, during her daddy time one evening, she told me all about her singing career, and she wanted to know how she should begin her singing career. And, of course, naturally, being the daddy and the man and the problem solver, I said, "Well, naturally, honey, you just need to write a letter to that Taylor Swift." Write a letter to her. She goes, "But Daddy, am I going to get a form letter back from the Taylor Swift organization?" And I said, "I don't think so. I think she's a fine young lady. She'll probably write you a letter back and invite you to her house." So she says, "Well, what if she doesn't?" I said, "Well, you and I'll just drive on over to Taylor Swift's house and we'll ask for some attention." I love that girl. I just love that girl. She loves me and I love her, pure and simple. She is Segula. She is not Segula. She is very, very Segula. Now, there's another special person in my family, and her name is Mariah. And she's 15 years old. I can't believe it. She's already talking about getting her driver's license. Okay, I prayed specifically to use good words today and to not put feet in mouth, so I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to try not to anyway. I spend time with Mariah periodically. I wish I could spend time with everybody more than I do, but I'm not a perfect daddy yet. Mariah is one who says, "I love you, Daddy." We have a little ongoing game around my house where I give everybody a chance to ask me questions. Sometimes around dinner, I'll say, "Does anybody have any questions for Daddy?" And they'll say, "I love you. I love you." I like that question. Now, Mariah does that quite a bit. She's the fastest one on the draw. "I love you, Daddy." Not only is Mariah beautiful, she's serving and quiet. And I'm not auctioning off daughters or anything like that today. Because honestly, I don't see enough men. I don't see any good men. Well, perhaps there may be one. There may be one or two. She's quiet, hardworking, and extremely smart. That's what I love about Mariah. She loves me, and I love her. Mariah is segula to me, and her mother, and her sisters. Megan is 18 years old this week. She's an adult. I had to point out a picture. Actually, I asked Sherry to do it. I pointed out a picture in the paper of somebody who was 19 years old who got his picture in the paper because he did something wrong and he's in jail. And I said, "All right, Megan, not that you'll ever do this, but now that you're 18, society takes the gloves off. They take the gloves off. And your picture can just as well end up in the paper as anybody else's picture who does something wrong." But Megan won't do that because she's segula. She's peculiar. She's special. She's holy. She's precious. Megan's my first. The one who, when I saw her born, I was still studying tax in college. And I said, "Another taxpayer enters the world." She's getting ready to start paying taxes, believe me. She's the one that's blazed the trail for her sisters in the house. As the first, I'm also an oldest, and I know just how hard that is. I mean, you get striped pretty good when you're the one that has to blaze the trail. And I appreciate that about her. She's held to a very high standard. Megan doesn't understand sometimes why Daddy's rougher on her than Marissa. Well, I say, because you don't climb up in my lap and talk to me about your singing career. But no, she's the first one. She's held to a higher standard, like it or not. That's the way it is when you're the oldest one. She's beautiful. She's intelligent. She understands math like it's right on the back of her hand. She teaches her sisters math as well. And she's very deep in thought and very curious person. Megan is segula. She's not segula. She's very segula. And there's some other woman who lives in my house who keeps all that stuff spinning. She keeps kids educated. She gave me those girls, and I'm appreciative of that from her. She's the creator of Camp Tomahawk. How about that? She had a dream for Camp Tomahawk about a year and a half before it started, and she executed on it, and now that camp serves all the church. We have about 100 people coming this year. Little number's a little bit down, but that's okay. Everything's spinning just fine, and it's because of Sherry. She's the one who does that. All I do is rub her feet periodically, invite her to the hot tub, and offer her a glass of wine once in a while. And then she tells me all the problems with Camp Tomahawk. Pretty special. Special people that live in my house. Very segula, peculiar people that live in my house, and I love every single one of them. Pretty special ways that I have prescribed for my daughters to live, much to their chagrin and sometimes when I have to say something that they don't want to hear. But daddies do that, right? Daddies do that. I have a big investment in these people who are segula in my house, a very big investment in them. That's why I drive what I drive. If you see my cars, you know what I'm talking about. All my money is tied up in blue jeans and tennis shoes and things for segula people, even cats. We have 7 cats now, which is really the blood pressure medication for my wife. God has segregated us out of this world and called us Segula. All of us are Segula, his special, peculiar people, actually called as the weak of the world. We may have been called as the weak of the world, but if we listen to him, our very purpose is not to remain the weak of the world, but in the opposite, it's to confound the mighty, isn't it? Eventually, if we play by the rules, God's rules, we will confound the mighty. The mighty will look at us and think, why is that family so successful? Why is that family so beautiful and achieving? Why is that? I'd like to take a look at how God plays the game. And I'm really going to honor God as a father today as well. I want to look at this God that we worship and this one who calls us special. Let's go over to Deuteronomy 20, if you would, please. Deuteronomy 20. I'm going to read verses 1 through 8. And I'm going to comment all through this because I think it's kind of funny in some ways. Deuteronomy 20, beginning in verse 8, 1. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you and brought you out from the land of Egypt. So it shall be when you are on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. And he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint. Do not be afraid. And do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. Then the officer shall speak to the people, saying, What man is there who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. Also, what man is there who has planted a vineyard and has not eaten of it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in a battle and another man eat of it. Notice the patience and the mercy that God is showing here to these men getting ready to go into battle. Verse 7, And what man is there who is betrothed to a woman and has not married her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in a battle and another man marry her. The officer shall speak further to the people and say, What man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest the heart of his brethren faint like his heart. God doesn't want fearful people in his army, does he? He wants bold people. He wants fearless men to fight these wars, actually to go and be ready to fight those wars. A special war strategy, wouldn't we all agree? Special rules for special Segula people, especially loved and separated by God himself, all based on his promises to his obedient servant, Abraham. We're the ones who benefit from that obedience, don't we? It's amazing just how well off we are in this nation. We turn water on and water comes out. We turn hot water on and we may have to wait 15 seconds, but it also gets hot. And it's amazing how blessed we are in this country. Now, in preparation for, of course, what we all think is going to happen in a few years, I've been working on my camping supplies and things like that. And I have a couple of these solar showers now. I've been practicing using these solar showers over the past few weeks. And what you do is you can get them at Walmart at $6.99. You fill it up with water. You put the black part down on a flat surface. And in 3 hours, you have a hot shower. This is really neat. But boy, that's a lot of work to do to have a hot shower. A lot of work. So I like playing with that, but it's really, really nice to, once I'm done playing with the outdoor shower and everything, to come on in the house and have a real shower. We're very wealthy in this country. God prescribes a very special way of living for his people who are Segula. Now, do we identify with that kind of people? Do we identify with being peculiar? Will we go out this week and introduce ourselves to new people as, say, I'm a peculiar person? We should. We're special people. We're peculiar. I may do that this week just to see what the response is. But I don't care these days. I just don't care. Do we identify as that Segula kind of people? I'd like to go look at a Segula kind of experience. Judges 6. Judges 6, beginning in verse 1, it says, then the children, now listen, I mean, what kind of promises did God say he would give to his people if they would just keep an eye on the commandments? What kind of promises did he give? Judges 6, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Notice how our Father treats us. You know, he knows what's good for us. He knows what's going to bring us back around. This is what a father does. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years, and the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which were in the mountains. So it was, whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts, perhaps as numerous as cicadas. But they and their camels were without number, these Midianites, these Amalekites, camped out against Israel, literally marauding everything that Israel worked so hard for. But that's why it happened, because the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They did not segulah in the sight of the Lord. Verse 6, so Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. The children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites. That the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel and said to them. Notice how faithful God was at this instance. He said, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians. Doesn't that sound like a father just saying, hey, I told you what would happen, but you didn't do it. You did evil. And so now you have suffered. This is a daddy talking to us about a special way to a special people. I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of who oppressed you and drove them out before you and gave you their land. Also, I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice. Probably delivered very calmly, coolly, patiently, and lovingly, as a faithful father should. Verse 11. Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which is in Ophrah, and belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress. Probably because he wanted to have some wheat for himself that would be hidden away from the Midianites, in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. Gideon said to him, oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? So we see some questions from Gideon, really not truly addressing the reason that situation was on them in the first place, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And you can read on through, and even Gideon at that point tested God's patience and asked him to show him signs and the rest of that. So I'd like to go over to chapter 7, Judges 7. Notice the peculiarity of our Father and how he works things out, how his ways work. Our ways don't, but his ways do. Judges 7, beginning in verse 1. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped against the well of Herod, so that the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them and by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, these people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me. Now therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid. Notice the consistency. the consistency of God. Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And out of 32,000 people, 22,000 men were afraid. This is a frightful thing, men. How many men do we have in the room here? Would two-thirds of us say, going to go back to the house because I'm scared? Hope not. And 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, I love this. This is like a fearless dad here. He says to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Then it will be that whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. So we got two specifically different kinds of men who are getting tested and separated here again. Verse 6, and the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But at the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. Then the Lord said to Gideon, by the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let the other people go, every man to his place. So the people took provisions and their trumpets in their hands. He sent them all, and he sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. So here we have an interesting battle shaping up. We've gone from 32,000 men, seemingly ready to rock and roll, down to 300 men. I heard an interesting commentary this week or the week before about that only 300 men were crouching and taking the water from the river to their mouth. In other words, watchful men, ready to fight, ready for a Midianite attack. Whereas how much longer would it take for somebody to come off of their stomach and back on their feet, gathering up their weapons and the rest of that? But the ones who watched that took the water, was watching and drunk from his hand, that must have been kind of impressive to God. He said, all right, you have 10,000. 9,700 didn't do it right. I'm going to take these 300. Continuing on, I'm glad we didn't have a sermonette today. We'll go a few minutes over if that's okay. I have 10 pages. I'm on page 7, and we're halfway there, so we'll make it. In verse 9, it says, it happened on the same night that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with... Now, we're only talking about 300 here, right? And he's still making an allowance for some that may be afraid because of the problem that being fearful causes. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterwards your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the valley, who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as the sand by the seashore in multitude. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed. Then his companion answered and said, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and his interpretation, that he worshipped. That was an appropriate response, wasn't it? He worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand." Then he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put a trumpet into every man's hand with empty pitchers and torches inside the pitchers. Verse 17, and he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. Follow my lead. Show you what to do. Watch, and when I come to the edge of the camp, you shall do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then you also blow the trumpets on every side to the whole camp and say, 'The sword of the Lord and of Gideon.'" Verse 19, so Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outpost of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, just as they had posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers. They held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, "The sword of the Lord and of Gideon." And every man stood in his place and all around the camp. And the whole army ran and cried out loud and fled. When the 300 blew the trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his companion throughout the whole camp. And the army fled to Beth Acacia. And then you can see what happened. I mean, that's what happened. What brilliant military strategy that was. You know, it says there in verse 21, and every man stood in his place all through the camp. In other words, they probably really didn't have to even break a sweat. They were just following the instructions, and God was the one who struck fear through the Midianites. A peculiar people, wouldn't we all agree? A peculiar story, a peculiar strategy, but it's a peculiar prescription given by the Creator God Himself to the people that He considers segula. Do we prescribe to that way? Do we live that way in our lives? Are we glad to be peculiar, to be known as peculiar, special people? Do we prescribe first and foremost to His ways and not ours? Two specifically different ways are outlined in Galatians 5. Galatians 5, verses 16 through 24, the fruits of the flesh and the fruits of the spirit, two specifically different ways. The fruits of the flesh, the problem of being human and physical will always be with us, but that also brings about a quality of being faithless and fearful. Verse 19 says, now the works of the flesh are evident, which are, and we're all guilty of these things from time to time, unfortunately, adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions and heresies, envies, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. One way we could choose to live our life, if we're not segula. But if we do recognize our segulaness, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such there is no law. No law against that. Interesting, I'm going to come back to that here in a few minutes, right towards the end, and point out something that I learned just this week about that whole passage. Again, which way do we wish to identify with? Are we glad to be peculiar and seek after the spiritual? Or are we content to be worldly and seek first and foremost the physical? So it's report card time, and we all get to judge ourselves. In this passage, which is in Ephesians 5 and Ephesians 6, my Thompson Study Bible shows captions such as, "What Christians Should Do," "Living the New Life," "Instructions for Christian Households," "Living in the Light," "Spirit-Guided Relationships," and our favorite of all things in this passage, "Husbands and Wives." It's report card time. Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 1. Again, are we segula or are we not segula? Segula or not segula? Therefore, be imitators of God as dear children, and walk in love, as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. So Christ has given himself for us. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for saints, as is fitting for segula kinds of people. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, those things are not appropriate for those of us who subscribe to segula. But rather, giving of thanks. Verse 5. For this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man who is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore do not be partakers with them, for you were once darkness. We were all once darkness. We all were that. Everybody was that once. But now you are a light in the world. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is all goodness, righteousness, and truth, finding out what is acceptable to the Lord, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. Won't that get us to start thinking? Won't that make us think if we dwell on that a little bit? Verse 13, but in all things that are exposed are made manifest by the light. For whatever makes manifest is light. Therefore he who says, awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. Verse 15, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Therefore do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Verse 20, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. And here's a kicker. Here's a key that's going to set the stage for everything else after this. Verse 21, submitting to one another in the fear of God. Number 22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. Submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. This is where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? Are we peculiar? Are we not peculiar? Are we segula? Or are we not segula? This is an order that God's giving us as to how our families are to be structured. 23, for the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, of course, that can't even happen unless verse 25 is in play. That can't happen. I know from experience that if I don't do this right, my wife's not going to do her part right. She won't. She can't. Number 25, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word. Oh, I forgot. More visuals. Verse 21 said, submitting to one another in the fear of God, right? So I'm drawing an illustration right here that I'm supposed to be the foundation of my family. I'm to be the foundation of my family. If I'm submitting to one another in the fear of God, I'm to be the foundation in my family. And this is my wife. Notice how beautiful this is. Am I segula or am I not being segula? There's going to be it'll come out. So this is my wife. I support her. If this was underneath the bricks, there would be a problem, as I'll illustrate in a few moments. Verse 26, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh and of his bones. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. You know, I read all that, and I've been studying this for a while. And you know what I take comfort in? There's also a scripture that says, remember the wife of your youth and be enraptured by her. And you know what? My wife is still, but I'll tell you, when she was 19 years old in college, man, she caught my eye. And we had a lot of fun. You know, being brand new married, we didn't have any money. We didn't have anything at all. We had an apartment. At the end of the month, when the money was almost gone, we had $17. And that was our entertainment fund, 17 bucks. And yet somehow or another, with the help of coupons and the rest of that, what was it, the value checks we used to get? We used to buy the value checkbooks for $10, a fundraiser for the church. And we'd be able to go to Beefy's and get two Beefy's hamburgers and a movie over at Blockbuster for the grand total of $5. We had dinner and a movie in the apartment out on White Ridge Road. And you know, when Sherry specifically gets a little out of line around the house, like, you know, she's apt to do from time to time, like she's apt to do from time to time, that kind of hurts. That kind of hurts to look at. But when she gets a little bit out of line from time to time, I think back of when we were just brand new married and how we had $5 to go out on all night long. And it really puts me back, especially when I tell her how much I love her. It kind of puts us all back in place. Those are the wrong ones to be working with, talking about Sherry and I, because we're segula. Excuse me, I made a mistake. I know she was going to tell me about that later, so fix that once and for all. Okay, the next chapter, Ephesians 6 in verse 1. It says, children, now this is just a reminder that these are peculiar rules for peculiar segula children as well. But we also know the source of those rules, those laws, comes from a very strong, a very powerful, an all-knowing, a merciful, faithful, loving Father who created us, knows exactly how we're all wired. He knows us. It says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, and oh boy, does this part hurt. This is the part that I've been accused of. I bet we're all guilty of this part. I try not to do this, but I do, just because sometimes I'm not very segula. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. So I got us a little whiteboard and put it up in the kitchen, and now everybody has to write scriptures on it. Do we do that every day? No. We sure try to. It's the standard to do. We try to get there, but I love seeing the scriptures that my daughters and my wife writes up and the ones that I put up as well. So this is the way it's supposed to look. This is the segula family, what we aspire to. There is a God-prescribed order, and the success of that order is completely dependent on all of us yielding to Christ than to fulfill our role as it's been defined. I want to go back to Galatians 5 for just a moment. Galatians 5, this is what I learned just this week, last week or late last week. Especially since this is the theme of camp this year, the fruit of the Spirit. I looked up all those words in the Strong's. It says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such there is no law. I thought it was very interesting. I noticed that all of the different aspects of the fruit were classified as feminine. Those are feminine qualities. Feminine qualities. Beautiful, right? Crystal, beautiful qualities. And yet the words that are around those beautiful words, the fruit is masculine. That word is masculine in the Greek. The Spirit, but the fruit of the Spirit is a neutral word. It's neutral. And then it gives all those beautiful qualities that we're all to have. And then it says, against such there is no law. So I look at that and I think, wow, I've got masculine, neutral, lots and lots and lots of feminine, and then masculine. I've got fruit and law, masculine. In other words, what I really have is all of that masculinity protecting this beautiful femininity. Isn't that interesting that those were the very words that was used to describe the fruit of the Spirit? So Sherry wonders why I've been so darn respectful to her lately. And it's because I learn these things and I try to put it into practice. We're all human. We've all made mistakes. We all make mistakes daily. And certainly nobody lives up to the perfect standard that we should. If we choose to do it any other way than that, catastrophe occurs. Now, this is too pretty. I actually bought this anticipating on breaking it with these bricks. But, you know, it cost a dollar at Dollar General. And I thought, I'm sorry, it's still too beautiful to break. I'm not going to do it. So I'll put it right here and save it for the next time I get to speak this. If we choose God's prescription and God's order, our relationships will look exactly like that. Are we willing to pursue this? To the world, God gives a peculiar way. But we know who God is. We know why He prescribes it, and the difference is worth it.